poorly trained. The Sok are professional warriors. They make a study of killing with magic. I've trained with them far beyond the basic exercises you learned in the SAS. I've seen what they can do. Bravery isn't enough. Skill beats will every time. You've learned something of discipline and self-denial in your SAS training. That'll give you a leg up over the average selfer, but not nearly enough of a leg up.
Yes, Oscar, get us out of here. Do whatever you have to do to make us safe.
But her eyes were hard. Britton nodded, his eyes scanning the group for a challenge. Swift turned away.
All right. If we're going to function as a unit, we need a commander. That's me, unless anyone else thinks they can do a better job.
A quick glance around the ranks showed him that nobody thought they could, or, if they did, didn't have the gumption to challenge him.
First things first. Many of you need healing and a chance to catch your breath. I'm going to have to gate us in outside a stronghold of creatures like Marty, but who are not friendly to us. And I can't have wounds or exhaustion slowing us down. 15 minutes, then we go.
Marty worked tirelessly alongside Therese, enduring his frozen feet in silence until Therese noticed his pained expression. Britton used his pocket knife to cut the bottom third of the parka away, wrapping the fabric around Marty's feet after Therese used her magic to repair the worst of the frostbite beginning to form on the goblin's soles. That had the added advantage of making the parka fit correctly. No longer tripped up by the long coat, Marty was soon moving around more easily. 15 minutes turned to 20. Swift waved at the hot air emanating from the fire, sweeping his arms and circulating it through the small shelter of the bent boughs, warming the air to a comfortable temperature. Therese leaned against a tree in exhaustion when the group's wounds were healed, but Marty would not sit still. While the rest of them rested, Marty examined the new world with absent-minded curiosity. He nearly danced with delight, his ears quivering, pointing at a cluster of juniper berries, before gathering them and pressing them into the pockets of his parka.
Can eat!
Marty raced back to them with a handful of shriveled and frostbitten-looking mushrooms. The goblin cast a worried eye at Therese.
Must eat! Can eat!
Do you think they're safe? He does have a knack with plants.
He has a knack for medicinal plants. But these are plants he's never seen before. He's in a totally different world. Being hungry is bad, but being sick right now would be a lot worse. Better not risk it. Sorry, buddy. I think you need to curb your enthusiasm here.
Can eat!
The goblin looked annoyed and began to gesture wildly.
Please, guy, you're at a 10. We need you at a round of 4.
Marty stuffed the mushrooms into his pocket with a resigned wave of his hand. A few of the enrollees had sagged against tree trunks in the magically heated air. Britton looked at Therese, sitting Indian style on the ground, her eyes drooping.
We're exhausted. Let's give everyone a half hour to grab some shut-eye before we move.
You sure that's safe?
No. But it's probably smarter than blundering back into the source ready to drop dead. Can you keep the air heated without that fire?
Swift nodded, and Britton turned to wave sign.
Can you get that put out, buddy? All right, people. Grab some shut-eye if you can manage it. We go soon.
He slumped alongside Therese and leaned against her shoulder. She didn't respond, but neither did she push him away.
I'm sorry. I tried to do what I thought best.
Later, Oscar. Later. Let's get out of here first.
The moon made a sparkling show of the trees and rocks as the enrollees gathered together for warmth. Swift's heated air made that largely unnecessary, but Britton knew that the closeness to one another kept the panic at bay. They weren't alone, and that was a start. Britton closed his eyes and listened to the sounds of the night. Britton thought he couldn't sleep, the adrenaline keeping him awake and alert to sounds, turning each frost-snapped twig into the footfalls of an approaching enemy. But fatigue won out in the end. He didn't know how long he dozed, drifting in and out of consciousness against Therese's shoulder. Fear and pain were momentarily forgotten. Britton sank into the warm glow of her nearness and drifted off to sleep. The warm air had dissipated, replaced by the reality of winter cold. Britton buried his face in Therese's hair and clung to the fleeing threads of his slumber. Beyond it lay cold and hardship, and if he could stave it off for just another moment, he would.
Oh no.
Britton shot awake. It was the sound of a helicopter. He reached out his arm and accidentally swatted Marty, who must have crawled to snuggle up against his back. Fritton reached over and pressed a finger to his lips.
Oh, what's...
Fritton pointed upward. Fritton propped himself up on his elbows. All around their small makeshift camp, the enrollees were crouched in silence, casting terrified eyes skyward.
What the hell was that?
I don't know. Could have been the Weather Channel, could have been the SOC. We can't stick around to find out. Let's get moving. Marty, you ready? They must be flying a search pattern. It's the only reason they would be going that slow.
Fritton was grateful for the thick clouds that had blown in while they slept. Little moon and even less starlight penetrated the forest canopy, leaving a black sea whose rocky bed was dotted with gnarled columns of tree trunks. Night was thick around them.
All right. Nothing more to be gained by hanging around. Let's get this show on the road.
It is challenging to make a study of the effects of latency on genetics. For one thing, manifestation is extremely rare, and it is rarer still for two latent individuals to mate and produce offspring under conditions that can be monitored for the purpose of scientific study. That said, there is promising statistical evidence to indicate that the children of latent parents are much more likely to manifest and to do so at a very early age. Avery Whiting, Modern Arcana, Theory and Practice.
The gate yawned across the clearing, 8 feet high, its shimmering, static surface offering a glimpse of the palisade wall in the distance. Long triangular banners draped down its surface, hidden in the darkness. Britton knew that they were crudely painted in the likeness of a bird skull, striped red and orange.
Hepahat or Depot, Sarahat, much fight.
Britton turned to the enrollees.
All right, the folks behind those walls may look just like Marty, but they're not friends. We get caught by these guys and we're done. But if we keep together, keep quiet, and keep moving, I'm confident we can get past them unnoticed. It's a chance, but as rough customers as these folks are, they're a cakewalk compared to the sock. And it's a far better bet than staying here. Everybody tracking? Peapod, I need you at the rear of the group. Keep folks moving.
Peapod nodded and took up a position.
All right, let's do this.
All was cloaked in shadow. Torchlight flickered from the turret that the creatures had repaired long since the rocket from one of the raiding Apaches had destroyed it. A new wooden structure jutted from one of the towers like some kind of cancerous growth, braced by roughly hewn crossbeams, crowned with a peaked slate roof. Its sides glistened wetly.
A water tower. They don't want their pyromancers busy putting out fires. They want them ready in case we come back.
Peapod ushered the last of the group through. They stood gaping at the giant palisade wall. Britton shut the gate quickly and began herding them away from the fortress. Tired and injured, the group made slow going.
It's amazing.
Swift ran his hands over the sawtoothed grass.
Later, if we're caught here, it's gonna get ugly.
All right, I'm moving.
Britton opened his mouth to say something, and all words fled. Directly before them, just a few meters away, a rickety tower had been erected. Wooden crossbeams supported a slate-covered platform some 30 feet from the ground. Above the platform, three logs rose, lashed together to form a crossbar. A massive rock sat astride it, black talons gripping the tree trunk thickness tightly. Its feathers were fluffed outward against the cold, making it look even larger. Not a crossbar, then, a perch.
Of course, it's a watchtower. They want to be able to warn the main stronghold if another flight of Apaches comes in.
The group froze at the sight, but the giant bird had already sighted them. It cocked its huge head at an angle, and a single, unblinking golden eye, the size of a dinner plate, fixed them. About its neck clung a goblin, his face buried in the creature's feathers, body entirely covered in white paste. For a moment, both rock and human stood in stunned silence. Then the rock spread massive wings and exploded off the perch, circling over them.
Run!
They scattered as the bird swept low. It made a pass, claws reaching out to snatch at Swift, but Pyre pumped his fist sending up a gout of flame. Peapod stood forward and placed her hands on her hips, concentrating. The massive bird recovered from the burn and dove again, straight at her, huge talons reaching. Then it paused, and Britton felt a surge in Peapod's flow as she whispered desperately, competing for control over the rock with the goblin pteromancer on its back. The giant wings beat the air and swung its head side to side in confusion. What little practice Peapod had ever had in whispering was no match for the goblin. Britton could see sweat breaking out on her forehead, her teeth gritting. Britton saw that three more rocks had taken flight moving toward them. It wouldn't take them long to arrive. He stepped alongside Peapod, reaching out for the goblin's magical current. It was difficult to pick it out from all the others around him, but eventually he felt it, a foreign flow in the midst of so many familiar ones. He focused, drawing the magic hard to him, then binding it to the goblin's flow, cutting it off. In an instant, Peapod's whispering won out, and the rock hurled itself skyward, righted, and launched itself toward its brothers as they winged toward it.
Phew, that was close.
Where'd you learn to whisper?
A bug here, a sparrow there when folks aren't looking. You figure it out.
Good thing.
His smile faded quickly. Even if they could defeat the rocks, they would slow them enough to bring the entire goblin tribe running to the attack. He spun on Marty, who was busy gathering up some of the enrollees cowering beneath the tower.
Marty, which way is your tribe?
Marty blinked at him for a moment, before pointing out across the field toward a long line of snow-capped trees. Britton sighted the line, imprinting it on his mind. He turned and opened a gate back on the rose bowl of moss.
Everybody move!
The group milled around uncertainly in the Vermont clearing. He opened another gate as far as he could into the tree line that Marty had pointed out. All came quickly this time. They were deep among the trees. The Sorahad fortress was screened by the thick mass of trunks.
Marty!
The goblin was already pointing before he could ask the question. Leapfrogging between worlds, Britton carried them what he guessed was many miles in just a few steps. When they finally emerged on a low rocky rise after the 10th hop, Britton saw a small hamlet in the distance. Mud houses crowded narrow dirt tracks, the roofs thatched with dried sawtoothed grass. A log wall, much smaller than the one they had just fled, surrounded it. Square blue banners dotted it at regular intervals. Even from that distance, Britton could make out the image of a gnarled tree embroidered into the surface. Beyond the wall, small garden plots stretched alongside sheds. Low wooden pens enclosed the same squat, hairy livestock that Britton had seen when he'd attacked the goblin fastness. Smoke rose from cooking fires beyond the palisade wall.
There! Matab Ansara! Home!
The goblins met them some distance outside the gates, astride the backs of giant wolves. A few goblin druids, their skin painted white, walked among them, but the wolf riders were warriors with dotted faces less elaborate than Marty's. They held spears, swords, and U.S. military-issued carbines far too large for their small bodies, and wore leather jerkins studded with a pattern that resembled the tree from the banners. At their head was a giant of a goblin, still smaller than even Wavesign by a head. A male hauberk was draped around his shoulders, and he carried a huge spear bearing a banner matching those on the walls. His face was patterned in white dots that matched Marty's exactly. The group paused, uncertain how to proceed, but Marty strode to the front of the group, shrugging off his parka and squaring his shoulders, suddenly oblivious to the cold. He seemed taller, radiating a confidence that Britton had never seen in him before. Gone was the curious, childlike creature that had shivered in the woods just a little while ago.
Ichaka Matfogat Not!
The goblin's eyes widened. Marty raised his hands, his ears standing up straight over his head. The entire party tapped their eyes, bowing deeply. The white-painted goblin sorcerers also bowed, but only slightly and from the waist, also tapping their eyelids. When they looked up again, their faces were joyful, and a few came forward to brush their fingers against Marty's closed eyelids or the tips of his ears. Marty endured it all with an air of entitlement, his hands on his hips to allow the group to get close. All except the spear-bearer, who stood, clearly unsettled, the weapon resting in the crook of his arm. One of the sorcerers remained with him. When the greetings were complete, Marty turned back to Britain. His lordling face was gone, and he was friendly Marty again, grinning like a happy child.
See? Important!
No doubt, buddy. Important as hell.
Marty wiggled his ears and led them into the gate, the wolf riders falling in as escorts around them, the spearbearer going in front. The village clustered around a broad plaza, the ground flat, covered with a carpet of moss that looked dry and comfortable. 10 glass-smooth stone chairs were arranged in a semicircle around a huge and ancient tree, wide and stunted like some giant bonsai. Britain recognized it as the tree from the banners on the palisade wall. 10 blue-robed, white-painted sorcerers, their ears sprouting tufts of long white hair, were already taking their seats. Ringed around them were scores of goblins, large and small. Britain recognized tiny children, as cute in their minority as they were ugly as adults. Females stood around the perimeter of the circle, wearing brown shifts that exposed single, long brown breasts. Some of them had the nipples pierced with a sparkling jewel of some sort, their faces painted with dotted patterns. The other females clustered around them in deference. The huge spearbearer stood forward.
Take two touch mar dripa for Ustlatsar!
The speech seemed to go on for a long time while the seated goblins listened, nodding occasionally. Britain turned to Marty to ask him what was going on, but was silenced with a wave. Whatever was happening, he was not to interrupt. At last, the spearbearer gestured back to Marty, who stepped forward. The spearbearer bristled at his words and started forward, but Marty intercepted him, reaching a hand down to the sole of his foot, then placing his hand against the spearbearer's chest. Whatever Marty had done, it was a grave insult or a challenge. Britain stepped forward, unsure of what was going to happen.
Okay, looks like everyone's here.
Humans and goblins alike froze, the goblins fixing him with angry stares. Wavesign grinned and raised his hands, flashing them his middle fingers.
That's nice, you scummy rats. Suck on this!
Wavesign, what the hell are you doing?
Britain could feel the boy's current, steady, disciplined, gathering solidly around him. Wavesign produced a small black box from his waistband and thumbed it. A red light blinked on the surface. The group backed away, but Britain knew that whatever it was too small to be a bomb. It looked more like a pager.
Or some kind of transmitter.
You sold us out, you bastard!
Wavesign grinned, his fist shrouded in a cloud of whirling ice crystals. He nodded to Britain, the confidence in his eyes making him appear much older.
Just following your lead, sir.
He leapt aside as a massive gate slid open behind him. Through it, Britain could see Billy, his mother gentling his shoulders. Around him, a SOC assault team was scrambling to their feet, racing forward, chambering round. Harlequin led them through the portal, his body breathed in crackling electricity. Shadow Coven followed, Fitzy grinning at its head.
Too smart by half, Oscar. You forgot you're not the only one with a gate.
Sir, the president is completely clear on this issue. If Colonel Taylor's theory is correct, then there is a tangible link between the Goblin Defender Tribes and the Mescalero Insurgency. More importantly, there is a connection between planes inherent in the environment and independent of portomantic magic. If true, this represents a cross-planar threat to the security of this nation and possibly the world. It must remain secret, and it must remain your top priority. Unidentified briefer to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on Closed Circuit TV.
25 soldiers burst through the gate, carbines leveled. Along with Shadow Coven and Harlequin came two more SOC sorcerers, pistols drawn and ready. Goblins surged forward to meet them, brandishing spears. Several of the white-painted sorcerers sprang from their chairs, leaping into the sky or bursting into flames. But it was Fitzy who fired the first shot. Pyre spun in a tight circle. The pyromancer sat down hard, gripping his stomach, blood flowing from between his fingers.
No!
Therese rushed to Pyre's side. Britain raced forward, slapping down one of the carbine barrels so the soldier fired uselessly into the dirt. He snapped open a gate directly in the middle of the soldier. Britton leveled the gate horizontally, sending it arcing through the ranks of the SOC assaulters. He pivoted neatly to lunge for Fitzy, but Harlequin appeared overhead and dove at him. Britton opened the gate to receive the burst and began shifting it into the Aeromancer's flight path, edge turning outward toward him. Then suddenly he was freezing. Wavesign grinned at him, hands extended. A cloud of swirling frost cloaked Britton, numbing his limbs, his teeth.
Once a traitor, always a traitor. I always said, I knew we couldn't trust you, Keystone.
I'm the traitor? You sold out everyone who trusted you.
I've never betrayed anyone. I've been carrying out my assignment just like good soldiers do. But you wouldn't know much about how to be a good soldier, now would you, Keystone?
The cold began to overwhelm him, and Britton shut the gate and opened another one on the sauna in the Air National Guard base where he'd been assigned. He slammed against the cedar wall and collapsed, willing the heat from the stifling chamber into his frigid bones. Britton took another moment to take in the silence, the pleasant smell of the cedar. The heat was as delightful as the absence of battle around him.
No time for that.
He opened a gate behind where Wavesign had stood a moment before and stepped back in, reaching for his neck. But the Hydromancer had moved on, and he grabbed empty air. Then suddenly, Britton's magic rolled back.
Thought you'd get away, didn't you?
Fitzy stomped at Britton's face. He rolled out of the way, catching the chief warrant officer's boot and kicking up to catch him in the small of his back. Fitzy fell on Britton, dropping an elbow into his shoulder joint, knocked it out of the socket. Britton threw Fitzy's bulk off him, scrambling to his feet. Fitzy was up in time with him, pointing his pistol at Britton's face. A grim smile spread across his face, but his arm was suddenly swept aside by a branch of the gnarled central tree. Britton saw Peapod gesturing to it, and the tree knocked the Master Suppressor flying through the air, slamming into Downing. Around him, wolves darted, snarling at their former masters. Britton spotted Richards standing among the SOC assaulters, whispering the animals on to greater ferocity. Fitzy sprawled face down in the plaza. A goblin warrior raced to him as he rose and thrust its spear through his arm, pinning him to the ground. Fitzy hauled on the spear and moved up the shaft to reach his assailant. The muscle of his biceps squelched around the shaft, oozing bright blood. Fitzy hooked his fingers into the goblin's eye sockets and slammed its head down onto his knee. As the creature collapsed, Fitzy spun on Britton, ripping the spear from his arm and casting it aside. Britton goggled. Even with a goblin-sized spear, the feat was impressive. Fitzy, covered in gore, looked like he had stepped out of hell. Britton staggered toward the edge of one of the smooth stone chairs and slammed his shoulder into it. Pain flared and ebbed. Britton tried his shoulder and found he could move it with some pain. All around them, the battle raged. Britton still felt his current blocked by Fitzy, who charged it. He was intercepted by the goblin spearbearer, who sank his teeth into Fitzy's shoulder. Britton clapped his hands to his leg, rolled on the ground.